Thank you, Rembrandt-san, for your kind introduction. And thank you, everyone, for coming to my presentation. So I'm going to talk maybe about 30 minutes, maybe 30, 35 minutes. I'm still jet-lagged, so if my speech becomes a little bit incoherent, please bear with me. So this paper I gave at the how do you call it, Deutsche Orientalistenstag in Münster last year, as a part of this panel. I forgot the exact name, but it was about the adaptation and the reuse of text. And then that panel was organized by Elisa Freschi and Philipp Maas at the University of Vienna. And basically, we are interested in sort of looking at the ways, different ways in which South Asian authors quote texts of earlier authors, and then how they quote, the manners of quotation. Like sometimes they twist things or misrepresent, you know, or how do you call it, like cite in a wrong manner or cite out of context. So we were looking into these issues. And I am looking at this very interesting case of Madhva's untraceable citations, which means he is citing something and then attributing that citation to a particular text, but we don't find these citations. So, introduction. In an important paper published in 2012, Elisa Freschi effectively establishes the significance of what we might call quotation studies, an area of study which has been underexplored. Among the many benefits that such a study can yield, Freschi points out that the study of quotation can reveal the way in which an author understood authority in his or her tradition. In this context, Freschi mentions an exciting case of the citations that Madhva uses to validate his own view, which are, however, untraceable. As Freschi points out, the topic of Madhva's quote is a controversial one because many works and passages that Madhva quotes occur exclusively in his works. For example, he would cite a passage and attribute it to a certain text, such as the Chaturvedashika, which no one ever heard of. Or after citing a verse, he would say, iti varahe, thus it is said in the Varaha Purana, but we do not find the passage in the editions of the Purana currently available. Or he would simply say, iti cha, without mentioning the source of his citation. In contemporary Indology, the topic of Madhva's untraceable quotes was systematically and extensively explored by Rolk Mesquita, again in Vienna, who argues that Madhva's untraceable quotes are, for the most part, not actual quotes, but his own creation. This claim has received considerable criticism from scholars belonging to the Madhva tradition. In that present paper, I shall first briefly describe the history and the nature of the modern controversy concerning Madhva's quotes. Then I briefly explore the possible implications of this controversy for Puranic studies and for the study of Vedanta as Hindu theology. The main part of this article, however, consists of an exploration of the writings of two important Hindu theologians in the 16th century, namely Appaya Dikshita and Jiva Goswami, who held opposing views with regard to Madhva's quotes. While Appaya rejects the validity of Madhva's untraceable quotes to refute the latter's Dvaita position, Jiva refers to the same quotes to validate his own Gaudiya viewpoint. By examining the respective points of those two authors, I hope to show the complexity of this topic, which, in my view, was not fully addressed in Mesquita's works. So the first section, the modern controversy, Mesquita versus B.N.K. Sharma. As Ludo Rocher points out, Mesquita is not the first scholar in the modern time to discuss the issue of Madhva's untraceable quotes, starting with Suzanne... What's her name? Siov. Scholars such as Betty Hyman, Helmut von Glasenapp, R.G. Whoops. RG went too far. Bhandarkar, V.S. Gatte, and so on, notice and address the intriguing nature of Madhava's quotes. Mesquite, however, is the first modern scholar to examine the issue in a systematic manner. In his monograph that was first published in 1997, Mesquite studies Madhava's untraceable quotes in detail and points out that these quotes are not only untraceable, but they also tend to support Madhava's unique teachings, such as the doctrine of fivefold difference, panchabheda, differentiating capacity, vishesha, and ontological hierarchy, taratamya. On the basis of Appaya Diksita's writing, Mesquite also examined Madhva's claim of being the third avatara of Vayu, which enables him to justify his citation of untraceable quotations. Based on these observations, Mesquite concludes that Madhva himself authored untraceable quotes to support his argument. Mesquite's work was severely criticized by Madhva scholars who believe that Madhva's untraceable quotes actually are citations of works that are presently not available or lost. BNK Sharma was most vocal on this. In a paper published in 2001, Sharma advising Mesquite, quote, "To err is human. Even supposing that professors, i.e. Mesquite's, charges against Madhva are due purely to errors of judgment, their cumulative effect may well have its own adverse repercussions. It would therefore be advisable for the professor to withdraw his charges, apologize to Madhva, and close the chapter for good once and for all." Unquote. One may note the harsh overtone in Sharma's charge. In response, Mesquite points out in his publication in 2007 that Sharma's defense of Madhva's untraceable quotes is weak. For example, Sharma writes, so this is Mesquite citing Sharma's writing, quote, "The Gita says God descends on earth in all yugas, and surely some of the gods too do so with him. Why disbelieve the ability of a great thinker like Madhva to be able to recapture lost shakas by his yogic spiritual power centuries ago for the benefit of posterity?" Unquote. This passage shows that Sharma bases his academic arguments on religious belief. Regardless of whether one believes in Madhva's supernatural power, the very fact that Madhva quotes thousands of verses that support his unique teachings and occur only in his own works, this fact itself appears to indicate that Madhva authored these verses himself. So second section, untraceable quotes in the Puranic studies. While Mesquite's conclusions concerning Madhva's untraceable quotes are generally convincing, the issue remains complex and does not allow us to embrace his view without hesitation. This is because the issue of untraceable quotes is related to the reliability of the currently available texts. In this regard, it is particularly challenging to deal with Madhva's untraceable quotes attributed to the Puranas, since the Puranic texts, corpora, are generally known for their fluidity. This means that there is a genuine possibility that untraceable quotes attributed to the Puranas are untraceable, not because they are an author's concoction, but because the text versions in the currently available editions differ from the text versions that were available to Madhva. Mesquite is aware of this difficulty and points out that there are a number of verses in Vedanta Deshika's work that he attributes to the Varaha Purana, but that are not traceable in the current printed Purana editions. In this context, the case of Skanda Purana verses cited by Dharma Nibandha authors is worth considering, which exemplifies the poor state of the textual basis of the current Puranic studies. The Dharma Nibandha authors, such as Lakshmidhara, cite verses from the Skanda Purana that are not found in the most printed editions of the Purana. However, a study by Adriansen, Bakker, and Isaacson in the 90s, based on the oldest surviving manuscript of the Purana dating from AD 810, led to the discovery of the many hitherto untraceable verses can be found in what seems to be the oldest text bearing the name Skanda Purana. As Bakker points out, this old Skanda Purana turned out to have hardly anything in common with the well-known edition of the Purana edited by Kushemaraja Sri Krishna Das. This means that there is at least a theoretical possibility that some of the verses quoted by Madhva, which Mesquite identifies as untraceable, may turn out to be existing in the Purana. The fundamental issue is that the most of the Puranas now available to us in print are not critically edited, and therefore they are not necessarily reliable. Any discussion regarding Madhva's untraceable quotes will remain inconclusive so long as considerable progress in research in the Puranic textual history has not been achieved. So section 3, Untraceable Quotes and Vedanta as Hindu Theology. As discussed, the issue of untraceable quotes is complex and does not allow us to accept a simple conclusion. At the same time, we should recognize that a list of Madhva's untraceable quotes compiled by Mesquita in his publication in 2007, for example, is more than 250 pages long. The sheer number of untraceable quotes found in Madhva's work makes it hard to believe that at least some of them, if not all, was his own creation. Mesquita's observation that these quotations tend to support Madhva's unique doctrines further supports this conclusion. If we accept that Madhva's untraceable quotation, at least some of them, were indeed written by Madhva himself to support his own teaching, then this seems to have significant implications for our understanding of Vedanta. In recent years, scholars such as Francis Clooney and Jonathan Edelman have argued that Vedanta needs to be understood as a discipline of scriptural exegesis, and therefore it is more appropriate to call Vedanta a theology than to regard it as philosophy. One of the distinctive characteristics of theology is its commitment to the text that the tradition considers to be divinely revealed. Theology in this sense is different from philosophy in a modern sense of the term, which requires no commitment or not so much commitment to any a priori principle. The goal of Vedanta, as it is traditionally understood, is to articulate coherent system of thought based on a core of revealed texts, such as the Upanishads, the Brahma Sutras, and the Bhagavad Gita. Therefore, Vedanta is fundamentally rooted in these works, and the commitment to any exegete to these works should have priority over their individual ideas. If, however, Madhva had his ideas first and then created fictional quotes to support his teachings, can his enterprise still be called Vedanta? Or do we need to modify our understanding of Vedanta as Hindu theology? These are some of the questions we need to address when dealing with Madhva's untraceable quotes. And then now finally, section 4, Early Modern Controversy, Appaya Dikshita versus Jiva Goswami. The previous part of this article presentation dealt with present-day discussion on the issue of Madhva's untraceable quotes and its relation to Puranic studies and Hindu theology. In order to further demonstrate the complexity involved, now I shall discuss how two prominent Hindu theologians saw the issue. One of them is Appaya Dikshita in 16th century, a prominent Advaita author from northern Tamil, who is remembered, among other works, for his Shivarka Manidipika, a sub-commentary on Sri Kanta's Brahma Sutra commentary. The other is Jiva Goswami, again 16th century, one of the six Goswamis of Vrindavan, who was a systematizer of the Gaudiya Vaishnava theology. Appaya Dikshita squarely rejected Madhva's untraceable quotes, while Jiva Goswami accepted and utilized some of them to build his own theological system. In this section, I first examine the initial two verses of Appaya's Madhva Tantra Mukha Mardanam, or Crushing the Face of Madhva's Teaching, and his old commentary, Madhva Mata Vidvansana, or Destroying Madhva's Doctrine, on these two verses. While Mesquita deals with these works, to some extent, I shall examine them in more detail, incorporating sections from Appiah's odd commentary that Mesquita does not discuss. Appiah's works are significant since he was the first author who explicitly addressed the issue of Madhva's untraceable codes. Although Mesquita claims that in 13th century, Balada Guru and Vedanta Deshika already criticized Madhva's quotes, it is not clear whether their criticism was actually directed against Madhva. Although the two authors criticized the practice of fabricating citations for one's own purposes, they did not specify whom they had in mind. So going back to Appiah, his Madhva Tantra Mukha Mardanam is a metrical composition refuting Madhva's commentary on the first five Brahma Sutras. He starts the work with the following verse, quote, "If one names the topic of scripture to be Shiva or Vishnu, that is accepted. For such an interpretation should be accepted by us who worship that Brahman, even if it is with qualities. The contradiction does not overtly manifest itself for those who know the principle of Nahi Ninda, nor is it appropriate to reject even a divergent meaning of the sutras if it is possible." Unquote. As an Advaitin, Appiah believes that the Brahman without qualities, Nirguna, is the highest reality. Nevertheless, in his opening verse, he demonstrates a concessive attitude towards the worship of Saguna Brahman as Shiva or Vishnu. The principle of Nahi Ninda, to which Appiah refers to in the above-cited passage, is first mentioned in the Shavara Bhasha. Quote, "Blame is not employed in order to blame what is to be blamed, but rather to praise what is different from that which is blamed." Unquote. So by referring to what does that mean is by referring to this principle, Appiah suggests that when Advaitins blame the or reject or attack the Saguna interpretation of the Brahma Sutras, we should not take this literally. Rather, we should understand that such a blame as a praise of the alternative, namely the Niruguna interpretation. Appiah also demonstrates his concessive attitude towards the worship of Saguna Brahman when he begins his auto-commentary with the Mangala verse that is dedicated to Krishna. So this is his sub-commentary. Quote, "May Mukunda always bestow good on me, Mukunda who appears constantly in a complete form, Mukunda who is grasped by the fortunate ones according to their taste, after they have opened up the lotus bud of their heart by the practice of yoga, though it takes a long time." Unquote. Since Appiah is the author of works with Shaiva leaning, such as Shiva Arka Manidipika and Shiva Archana Chandrika, one might expect him to dedicate his Mangala verse to Shiva. That he offers it to Mukunda or Krishna suggests that for him it does not really matter whether one worships Shiva or Vishnu, because in any case, the highest reality is Nirguna Brahman. This is also the interpretation of Phalgat Narayana Shastri's Tippani on Appiah's auto-commentary. According to Shastri, Yataruchi, or according to their taste, so Appiah says you can see God according to the taste, means, quote, in the form of Rama, Krishna, or Nataraja, unquote. So, whatever form you like. In his auto-commentary, Appiah explains that the Advaitins too accept the worship of Saguna Brahman, since it helps them to understand Brahman's nature, quality, greatness, and so on. He further says that even for the Advaitins, the worship of Saguna Brahman is necessary for attaining liberation and other desirable aims. Quote, "Indeed, we Advaitins too require the worship of these deities, these two deities, meaning Shiva or Vishnu, because we need the controlling of our mind, which is conducive to meditation, for the sequence of experiencing celestial enjoyments in the heavenly places such as Kailasa and Vaikuntha, and for its result in the form of liberation." Unquote. Appiah makes it clear that worship of Saguna Brahman is something required, apikshita, for the Advaitins. From Appiah's perspective, The Vaishnavas, such as Ramanuja, who worship Vishnu or Saguna Brahman as the ultimate reality, are not entirely correct. However, their worship is not entirely meaningless, since it leads to a good result. In fact, Appaya even accepts that the Brahma Sutras can be interpreted as teaching Saguna Brahman, since in his view, to quote, the sutras are multifaceted, unquote. Appaya ends his auto-commentary on the first verse of the Madhva Tantra Mukha Mardana with the following rhetorical question, quote, why should we not accept the doctrine of Ananda Tirtha, that is Madhva, too, which aims at investigating by means of shrutis, smritis, and reasoning the nature of the Lord Narayana, his inconceivable and astonishing qualities, greatness, wealth, and power, the procedure for his worship, and so on, and the sequence of the enjoyments that are its, meaning, yeah, worship's result, unquote. If Madhva teaches Saguna Brahman, and if Appaya thinks the worship, its worship of Saguna Brahman is required for the Advaitins, then why does Appaya reject Madhva's teachings? Appaya answers his own question in the second verse of the Madhva Tantra Mukha Mardana, quote, nevertheless, we cannot accept the teachings of Ananda Tirtha in which the norm of those who follow Vedic passages becomes greatly confused, unquote. In Appaya's view, Madhva's teaching should be rejected not because it teaches Saguna Brahman, but because the way he teaches does not comply with the accepted norm in the Vedantic discourse. This is where Appaya addresses the issue of Madhva's untraceable quotes. Appaya spells this out in his odd commentary. Appaya's criticism against Madhva is both theological and epistemological. He voices his critique as follows, quote, even if we should accept the interpretations of others concerning Brahman with qualities in the manner mentioned, even then we can never accept the interpretation of Ananda Tirtha. For, in the interpretations of others, there is the difference of procedure in a few sutras only, as having as their object Brahman with qualities, without qualities, distinction, non-distinction, and so on. Concerning other sutras, however, there is no disagreement regarding the outcome, even if there is sometimes a difference of procedure in arranging the prima facie view and the conclusive view. In Ananda Tirtha's interpretation, however, difference of procedure is in fact almost everywhere, unquote. Appaya accepts that there are Vedantic views other than Advaita, and acknowledges that these provide legitimate interpretations of the Brahma Sutras. Appaya, however, rejects Madhva's teaching because of difference of procedure, prakara veda. The point seems to be that often Madhva has an entirely different scheme for understanding the Brahma Sutras. For example, according to Shankara and Ramanuja, Brahma Sutras 1.4.23-27 constitute a section dealing with the topic of Prakriti, the primordial matter that is the source of material universe. However, Madhva says this section deals with the principle of Samambaya, which explains how all the words in the Shruti ultimately refer to Brahman. Appaya further says that this difference of procedure concerns the contents which are not agreed by others, which are concocted by him alone, unquote. What Appaya means is that while other Vedantins build their teachings based on actually existing Shruti and Smriti texts, Madhva's teachings is often based on texts that no one has ever heard of. As Mesquita points out, Appaya then gives a list of those obscure texts Madhva cites from. The list gives 29 texts such as Agnivesha and the Valaveya, which according to Madhva are Shruti texts. It also names another 10 texts such as Brahmatarka, which from Madhva's perspective are not Shrutis but are authoritative. After listing the obscure texts Madhva cites, Appaya analyzes Madhva's strategy to counterbalance their obscurity. As Mesquita points out, this is where Appaya addresses Madhva's claim for being the third avatara of Vayu. Quote, in order to remove suspicion concerning his own untrustworthiness, which arises as a result of citing these works, Madhva proclaims that he himself is the third avatar of God Vayu after Hanuman and Bhimasena. So this is, unquote, this is Appaya. Then Appaya provides two passages that Madhva uses to justify his claim. The first one reads as follows, quote, "The first incarnation of Vayu is named Hanuman, the second Bhimasena. As for the third, it is Purna Pragya, who accomplishes the work of the Lord," unquote. The second verse is from the Rig Veda, which says, quote, "In this way, that which is visible is carried for the body," unquote, whatever that means. Although Appaya apparently holds that the first passage, thinks that the first passage to be a Smriti text, it is actually Madhva's own composition that can be found in his Mahabharata Tatparya Nirnaya. The second passage is identifiable as Rig Veda 141. However, as pointed out by Phalgat Narayana Shastri in his Tipani, this Vedic passage praises Agni, and it has nothing to do with Vayu. Quote, "By this praise of Agni, the excellence of the offering to Agni is made clear. By this it is pointed out that Madhva's explanation of this Rig Veda passage as being intent on the third, being intent on the triad of Vayu avatars indicates heavily that he transgresses the boundary of Vedic precepts." So basically this Appaya's point is that the Madhva makes... He makes this claim of being the third avatar of Vayu, but the textual reference that Madhva gives, these two, one is from his own text, and then the other is Rig Vedic passages, but it's about Agni, but he takes it and then use it to support something for Vayu. So it's a completely out of context. So this is an example where Madhva twists the meaning of an existing passage for his own purpose. In short, Madhva's claim for being the third avatar of Vayu is supported either by his own composition or by a deliberate misrepresentation of an existing text. Appaya says Madhva's claim is nothing more than his imagination and concludes his analysis by stating, quote, "We observe that Madhva repeatedly transgresses the norm of people who follow evidence," unquote. It is worth reflecting on Appaya's charge against Madhva that he transgresses the boundary of scripture authority, pramanika maryada alanganam. As an Advaitin, Appaya ultimately does not accept Madhva's ontology, which is dualistic and theistic. At the same time, Appaya's fundamental problem with Madhva is not his ontology as such. Appaya acknowledges that there are valid Vedantic views which are not Advaita. He even praises the benefit of worshipping Sagana Brahman. However, what Appaya finds problematic and unacceptable is the way in which Madhva builds his ontology. From Appaya's perspective, Madhva's teaching is unacceptable because he does not follow the rule of the game. What is implicit in Appaya's criticism is his understanding of the nature of Vedanta, that in Vedanta, one should formulate one's opinion based on commonly available textual sources. When Madhva cites texts that no one knows, this is a threat to the discipline itself, because this challenges the very notion of scriptural authority, Shabda Pramana, that is the basis of Vedanta. Now, section 2, Jiva Goswami. In the previous section, I discussed Appaya's criticism against Madhva's use of untraceable citations. Appaya's argument is clear and forceful. However, the matter is complicated by Jiva Goswami, who, unlike Appaya, accepts some of Madhva's untraceable quotes as authentic. Jiva was a contemporary of Appaya, who lived in North India in the 16th century. He was one of the so-called Shat Goswami of Vrindavana, who established the foundation of the Gaudiya Vaishnava school that was initiated by Chaitanya. It is not clear to me whether Jiva knew Appaya's works. As far as his discussion of Madhva's quotes is concerned, Jiva does not address Appiah's criticism. Jiva's view on Madhva's untraceable quotes is significant in our discussion because it shows that the authenticity of his quotes was accepted not only by Madhva's immediate followers, but also by those Vedantins outside Madhva school. So if you see, Madhva's commentary on Bhagavata Purana, and then if you see a commentary of Vijayadvaja, for example, who is again Dvaitin, then you really see that these Dvaita followers really accept almost all the quotations cited by Madhva. So that Madhva followers didn't have question is very clear. But now the point is that the Jiva Goswami, who is belonging to different school, also accept at least some of the Madhva's untraceable quotes. And then that's interesting. And then I have this section sort of discussing this point, why Jiva Goswami as a Gaudiya author is belonging to different school than Madhva. I have this section, but I skip this because it's a long, and then you're welcome to read my book if you like to get into this topic. But for this presentation, I just proceed with the understanding that the Gaudiyas, in which Jiva Goswami is one of them, is different from Madhva's. So, and then from Jiva's perspective, the untraceability of certain texts perhaps does not pose such a challenge, since he believes there are many texts lost and hence not available to us. In his Tattva Sandarbha Anucheda 12, Jiva states that at present moment, samprati, scriptural authority, shabda, means itihasas and the Puranas, because the Vedas are difficult to go through in their entirety. In his odd commentary, Jiva explains that the expression the present moment referred to the age of Kali, and the Vedas are difficult to go through because some texts are not available and because we lacked intelligence to comprehend the works that have come down to us. Radha Mohan Goswami further clarifies that the Vedas are difficult to go through in their entirety, quote, because some Vedas are destroyed and some concealed, unquote. Appiah's main criticism against Madhva was that Madhva transgresses the boundary of scriptural authority. If we accept Jiva's view on scripture, however, the boundary of what constitutes authoritative text becomes much more ambiguous, because in Jiva's view, there is always a possibility that certain texts are untraceable, not because they are fabricated, but because they existed formerly, but they are now lost and unavailable. Then in Anucheda 28, Jiva addresses Madhva's untraceable citations. This is in the context of Jiva's discussion of the scriptural means of knowledge, Shabda Pramana. Like many other Vedantins, Jiva says that scriptural knowledge is the only means to understand Brahman. Concerning the use of scripture in his own work, Jiva first says that he will cite the Shrutis and Smritis exactly as he saw, yata drishtam eva. However, to this general principle, Jiva adds an exception. This exception is Madhva's untraceable citation. Quote, and in some cases, I humbly accepted sources that I have not seen myself from glorious texts, such as the Bhagavata Tatparya, the Bharata Tatparya, and the Brahma Sutra Bhashya of glorious Madhvacharya, who is the ancient teacher of realism, who greatly propagated a particular Vaishnava thought, who has, as his disciples and grand disciples, the best among the knowers of the Vedas and their meaning, such as Vijayadvaja, Brahmatirtha, and Vyasatirtha, who were well known in the southern countries, and so on. Unquote. The key expression in the above-cited passage is that the sources that I have not seen myself, Svayam adrishta karanani. Svayam adrishta karani. Unquote. When Jiva realizes that certain quotations are found only in Madhva's works, he accepts these passages as authoritative, even if he cannot trace the original. Jiva does not discuss the authenticity of these quotes. Jiva has a very positive attitude towards Madhva and his followers. And this is expressed, for example, in his description of Madhva as a teacher of realism, Tattvavada Guru. Tattvavada was the term Madhva used to describe his own teaching, in contrast to Mayavada, which refers to the Advaita teaching. While Jiva teaches many Gaudiya doctrines that Madhva followers did not accept, Jiva agrees with Madhva in his severe critique of Advaita Vedanta's non-dualism. In this regard, Jiva's respect for Madhva's teaching appears as a natural consequence of their doctrinal agreement. Another place where we observe Jiva's reverential attitude towards Madhva tradition is his description of Madhva's followers as being well-known in the southern country and so on. For example, Vijayadvaja was well-known as the author of the Padaratnavali, which is the first full commentary on the Bhagavata Purana within the Madhva tradition. As for Vyasa Tirtha, VNK Sharma calls him the prince of dialecticians of the Dvaita school, unquote. He was a famous author of the Nyayamurita, which later prompted an Advaitin Madhusudana Saraswati, 16th century, to write his refutation called Advaita Siddhi. All these points indicate that by Jiva's time in the 16th century, the Madhva Sampradaya had become a well-established and well-respected Vaishnava tradition like that of Ramanuja's Sri Sampradaya. For Jiva, who was establishing a new tradition of Gaudiya Vaishnavism, therefore, referring to the older tradition of Madhva was a part of his strategy to present his theology in a respectable manner. After glorifying Madhva and his followers, Jiva quotes passages from his from Madhva's Mahabharata Tatparya Nirnaya. Quote, so this is Madhva's writing, just as Lord Vyasa, who is apparently Lord Narayana, spoke in the Mahabharata and so on, knowing other scriptures in the light of Vedanta and after seeing different types of books in various countries, in the same manner I, i.e. Madhva, speak by examining these books. Unquote. In these passages, Madhva claims his Vyasa-like authority in the Mahabharata Tatparya Nirnaya, which is his summary of the Mahabharata. By referring to these passages, Jiva expresses his high regard for Madhva and emphasizes the scriptural authority of his writings. Then, at the end of the Anucheda 28, Jiva gives the list of the texts which appear only in Madhva's works. Quote, among them, the Shrutis are the Chaturvedashika and so on, which are selected by him, and the Puranas are the section of the Garuda Purana and so on, which are not available anywhere at present. Furthermore, the Samhitas mean Mahasamhita and so on, and the Tantras are the Tantra Bhagavata, the Brahma Tarka, and so on. In his Madhva Mata Vidvansana, Appaya mentions the Chaturvedashika, the Mahasamhita, and the Brahma Tarka as extremely unknown and therefore untrustworthy. Jiva thus accepts as authoritative precisely the same works that Appaya rejects. Jiva's argument is simple. Many texts became lost or inaccessible in the course of time. However, Madhva's untraceable quotes must be authentic because glorious teachers of the Madhva school quote them. Therefore, even though he cannot trace the original, he can use those untraceable quotes to build his Gaudiya theology. Conclusion. In this paper, I have explored the issue of Madhva's untraceable quotations and its implications. As I described, the modern-day controversy between Mesquita and Sharma has a prelude that goes back at least to the 16th century. Appaya criticizes Madhva for citing unknown texts because it goes against the Vedic norm. Appaya's presupposition is that Vedanta is fundamentally a discipline of scriptural exegesis, and one's opinion should be based on the texts that are commonly available and accepted to be authoritative. Clooney's view that Vedanta is better understood as theology resonates with Appaya's argument. While Appaya criticizes Madhva for violating Vedic norm, Jiva poses the question of what exactly constitutes such a norm. In his view, many works that were once existent are lost and therefore no longer available. The phenomenon of lost text is in fact observed as discussed in relation to the Dharma Nibbana author's citation from the Skanda Purana. For Jiva, therefore, the obscurity of text does not necessarily indicate that they lack scriptural authority. Furthermore, that Jiva cites, that Jiva cites Madhva's untraceable quotes, this fact itself adds authority to those quotes and becomes a reason for Jiva's followers to cite them as authoritative. So if you see later Gaudiya authors, they cite Madhva's untraceable quotes that were already cited by Jiva, and then you see this continuation. So certainly, Mesquita's contribution is groundbreaking and significant. At the same time, I hope to have shown that this passage is more complex than he analyzed. So, is Madhva's face crushed? Perhaps not yet. Thank you. So, I'm happy to have any question or comments if there was anything obscure, or yes, please.
Thank you. I'm wondering though, perhaps Abhaya Dikshita's the prelude to his critique, or the reasons that he gives before he actually addresses the untraceable quotation to refute Madhva's doctrine. I wonder if that's not particularly naive, that you you just work with the text, and from the text you kind of get the meaning, and you don't bring anything of your own to the reading of the text as he's suggesting, because in a sense that's what they're all doing. They have certain notions of what the texts are about as a whole that they then use to make sense of individual passages in the text, and so they're all bringing already a lot of baggage with them to the text. And it's kind of there's a couple of comments I have that are somehow related. I'm just going to
that's fine.
And then you can do with them what you want. It's something like that Rigvedic passage that he cites there. I mean, that's that's a passage that in the Madhva tradition is very well known, and if I remember correctly, Madhva himself comments on it and reads this hymn that's supposedly about Agni in a particular way, so that it's actually about Vayu, and talks of the three avatars of Vayu who are there to assist the Lord in his mission and so on. And I mean, in a sense, what he's doing there is what a lot of people are doing in this period, where they're reading these Vedic texts and really coming up with radically different meanings than you'd read in any English translation, or part of the assumption is that these texts are not easy texts. These texts are obscure texts, and therefore, what we're doing in saying this particular syllable actually means this whole
sentence.
Is actually justified because they're actually really obscure texts that are hard to understand. And so I think that there's something I'm not saying that I particularly convinced by Madhva's reading of that passage, but I think there's something more complicated going on than Abhaya Dikshita is perhaps willing to admit. But then the other thing, as I mentioned, we're reading Jayatirtha, and I particularly like Jayatirtha because, in a sense, what he's doing, Madhva has all these untraceable citations, and what Jayatirtha is doing is kind of taking Madhva's readings and bringing them back to basic Vedanta texts, and he cites some of these texts that Madhva cites as well, but he seems to have this real effort to say, okay, Madhva's sources. I'm wondering whether actually Jayatirtha is aware of the problematic status of Madhva's sources, and in doing that defend it, he's basically saying, well, Madhva's sources may be unusual, but his readings or not, because I can give the same readings.
Sure. Sort of yeah.
Anyway, so that's just a couple of. Because anyway, the Jayatirtha thing, the reason why I bring that up is, as I said, I wonder if that's not, one of the Madhva defenses is that, Jayatirtha and Vyasatirtha, the great systematizers of Madhva Vedanta, don't bring up the fact that these are untraceable citations, which means they must have not seen these as untraceable citations, which means, Madhva would not have written these texts, but they would actually have access to these texts as well. And so I'm wondering whether Jayatirtha's sort of whole attempt is not sort of an admission that some of these things are untraceable.
Sure. Yeah, that these are all like sticky questions. For the first one, the interpretation of text. Mm. Of course that the now we know this death of author and that text has its own it's up to reader in some ways that to interpret, and the authorial intention in some ways it's not the most important element to it. And then after all, I guess if you think about it, the Vedas, if Vedas are authorless, then where's authorial intention anyway? So those things come, and then therefore if there is some obscure text, there are like different ways in which you can come up with interpretations, and then that's precisely Madhva say Deepak Sharma's the work on limit of philosophical investigation. What was it? That Deepak Sharma's work on this insider epistemology is really talking about that the. You have to be an insider to understand Madhva's teaching, because there are these obscure texts which you cannot understand by yourself, or even if you could understand the text, there are like these oral instructions that you need to have to understand it in a proper context, and without these you cannot. And then if you come up whatever understanding you come up without going through this insider initiation is just, at least from their perspective, it's not valid, right? So that's all given and accepted and all that, but I think the... accept these points, but then I think still difficulty is that it's just so many of them, right? So not only about the fact that the certain interpretations seem to be a little bit somewhat forced, which like everyone does to some extent, but not only that, but the very basis of that interpretation, that the text itself, right? If that's already somewhat untrustworthy, I think that's the issue.
Yeah, I mean, one could of course argue, if you see sort of what Ramanuja cites and so on, naturally there are passages he cites in support of his thing that really suit his interpretation.
Exactly.
So I mean, one could argue that the fact that Madhva quotes verses that really support his theology in itself is not an argument to say that he fabricated them, because it's you're naturally going to look for passages that so even traceable passages generally reflect the views of the author that cites them.
But I would say, not that I've gone through thoroughly the Madhva text, but like in my feeling, like let's say if you're looking at the Madhva's commentary on Bhagavata Purana, the tricky thing is that he mixes traceable quotes with untraceable quotes. Yeah, so he quotes like a text that everyone knows, but then he kind of throws in text that no one knows. So it's like if you kind of just read it with faith, it's sort of as if you have like 10 quotations to support his argument. But in my feeling, I don't know how it's your feeling, but in my feeling, maybe 25% of these quotes, I would say, you cannot trace. So 1 in 4. I mean, I think that's a lot. You know, that's different from, I mean, this is just my own sort of subjective sense of just reading maybe some of his Brahma Sutra commentaries and commentaries on Bhagavata Purana. But that's a very high percentage. Yeah. So the Appaya lists. Appaya lists. What is it? Like 29, like roughly like 30 to 40 texts. That are, Appaya lists about 35 texts or some. Yeah, about 35 texts that are named. That, but you don't know, like this Balabeya Shruti, like what is it, like, you know, is it even Sanskrit, you know, Agnivesha, yeah. So, but apart from these texts that you never heard, but there are untraceable quotes referred to also these texts which he attributes to like whatever existing Purana that everyone knows, like Iti Barahe. But you don't see it in Barahe, so where is it from, right? So if you like it, actually carefully trace it, yeah, it's like 1 in 4, if not 1 in 3.
Yeah, I always consider the Puranic citations, as you mentioned, to be an entirely different issue, just because the Purana
are
very fluid. But I'm also wondering, you know, the Iti Cha verses that you mentioned, you know, where he just quotes a verse and it says Iti Cha, and there's this one as well. Whether he actually intends them to be citations or sort of actually considers them to be his own. I mean, why doesn't he say, you know, particularly if he's making up these texts, why is he not saying, okay, this is from, you know, the Balaveya Shruti, which no one knows anyway, so I can say it's from there and no one can say anything.
Yeah. I don't know, maybe he runs out of stock sometimes. I don't know. Or... You know, I mean, sometimes I think authors, I mean, like many commentators, they don't necessarily like cite the source, right? You just quote and then iti, and then you sort of assume that everyone knows, like Amara Kosha, like, you know, anyone who's gone through traditional training just memorized. So it's enough to refer to the text, and then sort of you expect them, okay, you know, that's from Amara Kosha. Maybe it looked like, you know, of course you know this text, sort of thing. So, but that's the first one. But then Jayatirtha's efforts, and is he sort of consciously, you know, making effort to show, and then that's quite possible. And then the fact that, you know, Madhva himself actually he does quote traceable citations as well, right? So that means like he knows the text, no doubt, and he knows how to kind of present it. Yeah. So definitely that effort is there, but the maybe. I mean, again, like if you look at the Sri Vaishnava tradition, the what was Ramanuja's guru? Was it Paramaguru that who wrote the? Yamunacharya's something Raksha, Pancharatra Raksha. Agama Pramanya. Agama Pramanya is Yamuna, right? So Agama Pramanya, for example, then so that's the, you know, work like trying to defend why Pancharatric texts are authoritative. So there is this texts, which perhaps that by the time of Yamuna, that maybe Sri Vaishnava is accepted as authoritative, but maybe not accepted by the wider audience. So then he had to kind of make effort to argue that why you can make argument using this particular text. So like certainly you see that like the people are concerned about which texts are acceptable and which are not, because I mean there are just so many tantras and mantras always like appearing, you know. So and then likewise, like for the Gaudiyas, they argue that the Bhagavata Purana is the most important text, like even higher than the so-called Samhitas, I guess, like four Samhitas. But then like Jiva Goswami has to argue why that is the case. I mean, it's not obvious to everyone that the Bhagavata Purana is higher authority than Padma Purana or Upanishads or Gita, right?
What is the significance of claiming to be an avatar?
Why? What is
the significance?
Significance. So basically,
and also, is that a Sri Vaishnava tradition? Do others do it as well?
Oh, this is the Madhva tradition. In the Madhva tradition, the Madhva himself says that he is the third avatar of Vayu, and then according to Mesquita's analysis, that's the way how he sort of justifies that he can come up, he can give these untraceable quotes.
So he himself was aware of the untraceability.
That's what Mesquita argues, but the again Madhva scholars doesn't seem to like that argument.
I mean, the other factor involved would be, you know, in the hagiographical literature, there's also the encounter and the I believe extensive instruction from Vyasa, right?
Mm.
In the sense, I mean, who's obviously, you know, who's quite central to much Vedic literature. So, you know, if you can accept that. Madhva spent some time with Vyasa, then he's obviously had access to. So within the theological reasoning of the tradition, it wouldn't be too difficult to accept, you know, the access to sort of, you know, these sorts of texts. And then I'm wondering as well whether you've explored the fact that Jiva sort of cites these quotes. I mean, is there some necessity philosophically for him to be citing these? And whether the fact that he's citing them itself is an indication of, and I know that you've explored this issue extensively with the relationship between the Madhvas and the Gaudiyas, but whether it serves as a sort of counterpoint to sort of separating the traditions, you know, too radically, that there's some sense in which there's an acknowledgement of some authority there, some major authority, you know. I'm just wondering.
What's the latter part of the question?
Whether the fact that Jiva cites these quotes is some indication of his acceptance of the special authority of Madhva.
I think I haven't done exactly like which verses where he cites Madhva's quotes, and I think that would be an interesting study to go through and pick up like Madhva's untraceable quotes in Jiva's works, and then in what context he's citing, but the not specifically in relation to actual quotations, but in terms of sort of ontological, you know, standpoint, that is Jiva is very much fond of attacking Advaita. Position. And that's very clear, and then even though, you know, sort of his Achincha Veda Veda position is sort of often criticized by Madhva followers, that's like too Advaitic or whatever, but if you see the Jiva's works, he's very much fond of attacking Kevala Advaita position. So in that sense, it's very clear that Madhva's sort of Dvaita perspective is very much in line with his argument. So I suspect it could be the case that he cites these texts, which Madhva argues this difference of Jiva and Brahman, for example. But that's my speculation.
Mm-hmm.
But the latter half of the question was the...
Well, the former part of the question was the sort of special status of Vyasa. I mean, not Vyasa, Madhva, in that he's had direct shiksha from Vyasa according to the tradition.
Yes, that's there. That's there, and then again, like the quotation that I referred to in Jiva's Tattva Sandarbha, he's not talking about this interaction, but he's citing that Mahabharata Paranirnaya, where Madhva claims himself to be having like Vyasa like authority in composing this Mahabharata Paranirnaya, which. Because his point is that Mahabharata is so much interpolation in Mahabharata. Mm. So he's saying that I've gone through many countries and I've gone through many manuscripts of Mahabharata, and here is what authentic Mahabharata story is. Right? So he's saying that I give you the authentic version of Mahabharata. And he does that with Ramayana too, and he calls it Mula Ramayana. Mm. Yeah, like original Ramayana or something like that. So yeah, Jiva definitely have very reverential attitude, and
And there's also this other issue of I believe it's in the Tattva Sandarbha where there is this notion of an original Purana with 1 billion, you know, shatakoti verses. You know, so there's only like 400,000 in total of extant on Earth. So the existence of many verses that are unknown is a theological possibility.
Yeah. And apparently in the sort of like a Buddhist tantric tradition also, because you know many tantric texts that refer to as authoritative is apparently later texts. You know, so when they have to argue like why that's authoritative. Like these so-called later revelation, right? And then they, like one way they argue is that, you know, like what was revealed earlier was like a smaller revelation, but there was always this bigger tantra, you know, which was kind of kept hidden because people are not ready. It's just too advanced. But now sort of like an audience is ready. It's like a mature, so we can have access to this advanced teaching, which is like often like left-hand tantric practices, which are like very dangerous sort of thing. So they kind of like a parallel phenomena are there, but just kind of
cites Madhva and that gives the very citation authority, and then people who cite Jiva citing Madhva give it double authority, implies that the theologians themselves are seen to have a certain kind of authority and insight that allows them to pick out texts that aren't naturally intrinsically authoritative, and that the Advaitins are not feeling that way. They do not feel that way about contemporary theologians and the way that they work. So I'm just curious about something. It sounds as if there's a theological underpinning there somewhere that I'm kind of curious about, and it reminds me of the idea that you get in that period, and maybe more in the Vaishnava tradition, I don't know, people who are willing to cite contemporary scholars, or I'm thinking of Rupa citing poetry, that do you get people citing contemporary poetry, they're obviously not a Shruti, but it seems like there's a period in which the notion of what you can cite as an authoritative source and what is whatever the authority that gives Shruti, that kind of seer, rishi, seeing a reality element. I mean, Whitney Sanford and Jack Horley have both written about this, that there are people who are both theologians and maybe poets, and maybe the poets are seers.
Exactly. I mean, definitely. I mean, like, these theologians are sort of holy person themselves as well. So.
And do the Advaitins not feel that way? I mean, do you feel like Abhaya Dikshita is not having a feeling?
Huh.
Not about
Yeah, not about Madhva, but the but I'm sure, like, in the, you know, Advaitic tradition, like, whatever Shankara says, it's a sacred, no? So I don't know.
Shankara cited fake verses. Do you think it would have been like Shankara?
Yeah. So I mean, you know, this, what Sundara Rahari and, you know, all these, so many texts, the reason why it's attributed to Shankara, you know, even though many people don't accept the historical authorship of so many texts attributed to Shankara, is because people respect, I mean, not just as a thinker, but as a some sort of holy person, right? Like some sort of like a, and then like a later tradition also identifies, you know, Shankara as some manifestation of Shiva and these things, you know, so this divine
deification,
exactly, deification happens all the time. And then in case of Madhva, very interesting that, I mean, that's why,
Thank you.
Well, I'm sorry to keep, yeah, please feel free to leave. Yeah, I mean that's this is kind of tapping into different issue of Adhikara. Precisely because those who can study Vedanta and who can actually write upon it had to have certain Adhikara. You know, they are not just anyone, right? So, like a Baladeva, for example, in defense of Madhva's this untraceable code, he says, you know, Baladeva was Madhva first and then converted to Gaudiya. So anyway, he says, well, the Madhva's untraceable code cannot be untrue. Why? Because he was a Naishtuki Brahmachari. And it is accepted that the Naishtuki Brahmachari does not lie even in dream. So he appeals to this ethical integrity of the author, yeah. So in that sense that these Vedantic authors are not just intellectuals, but then they're also sadhakas, and not just sadhakas, but then they're ideal sadhakas, and then in many cases in the tradition they are seen as someone who actually, either human being originally, but have attained like a liberation, or even better, like was liberated from the beginning, but came down to save people like us who are blind, right? So definitely, this divine status is given.
Wasn't there something you mentioned that Jiva says about Madhva, that he's like, I think it's he's as Vyasa.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so Madhva, in the same, you know, and he has a whole account of what he means by Vyasa's insight into divine reality in the type of Sundarbha, right?
Right.
So there is that Rishi-like sort of function of of Madhva.
Yeah, exactly. So this like head of these sampradayas, I think, often are seen as like empowered, and then in the 16th century onwards, maybe even 15th century onwards, this idea of Chaturu Sampradaya, this four sampradaya, and then this head of the sampradayas were like divinely chosen, right? Like a Brahma accepted Madhva, and then Sri accepted Ramanuja. These things definitely gives like a divine authority to this head of the sampradayas. So yeah, apparently like whatever they say, or like, you know, maybe they're kind of charismatic leaders.
And there's something that we noticed when we were reading Madhva's commentary to the Isha Upanishad that is, I mean, Arambok pointed it out, but is the very sort of terse kind of just quoting a verse or a brief line or so, and there's something sort of almost categorically different from the way Jayatirtha goes about it, in that he's citing other Vedantins, etc., and it's much more sort of, in a sense, theological, you know, as opposed to sort of visionary, in a sense. You know,
yeah.
This is, you know, he's kind of intuiting the meaning of a particular, without citing anything else, just this is it here, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and then often just the, Madhva's commentary. I mean, often, like, Madhva's commentary is just the compilation of verses, or compilation of citations, which are traceable, or sometimes untraceable, sometimes traceable. but the yeah, sometimes like it's very terse, and then you just don't quite understand what he wants to say.
It's almost like he's kind of begging for someone to comment upon him, and thereby raise his text to the level of sort of canon.
sure. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not begging, but you know, is it?
Yeah. So I mean, definitely. I mean, definitely. You know, for the Madhva. I mean, for the Madhva followers. I mean, like Ananda Tirtha is like, whatever avatar or you know. He just got some supernatural.
But then maybe Shankara would have done exactly the same thing if he'd flipped to Shankara. Maybe Appaya Dikshita would have done the same thing. We'd have a flip, a reverse mirror version if it was if you took the Sundarya Lahari as the untraceable
sure.
And the Vedantins got to clip it by Shankara's total authority and everyone else is not sure about that. But the same, you know, it's not. Then it's Appaya Dikshita is just going, well, I don't like Madhva, so I'm not going to support his authority. And
yeah.
In the end, the debate is just really a debate about whether or not.
Yes. That's right. But then at the same time, that the we have to remember, Appaya Dikshita also has criticism of like Ramanujan and other schools as well. And I haven't read the other works of Appaya Dikshita, but the I suspect this is sort of particular issue that he raises with the Madhva followers. Maybe.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for your time, and thank you for the discussion.